Hey, everybody. Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on this Friday edition. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. And with me today is going to be Steve Behnke and Tim Felsted. They're going to be here to highlight the draft community energy plan. We're going to hear a couple of special reports, one from the Juno Icefield Research Project and another about Gordy Tentries, who's playing Friday and Saturday at the Alaskan. And Christy Nami Erickson will be here to talk about the details of Sunday's community art and dialogue event and to discuss racial justice and anti-violence. That's all happening, coming up, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, much more on this fairly rainy Friday afternoon. Join us, won't you? We're going to be back with you right after National Native News.
With National Native News, I'm Stephen Emmons, in for Antonia Gonzalez. A proposal in the U.S. Senate aimed at cutting off the international sale of Native American artifacts got a boost this week. Two Republicans are reaching across the aisle to support the Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony Act. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinsius reports, the bill would double the penalties for exporting the objects.
Arizona Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake joined New Mexico Democrats Tom Udall and Martin Heinrich in support of the STOP Act. Under the proposal, anyone caught smuggling the items out of the U.S. could face 10 years in prison, along with fines. It comes after several high-profile auctions in Paris of objects from the Navajo, Hopi, and Acoma Pueblo, among others, and attempts by the tribes and the U.S. Justice Department to halt the sales. McCain says the bill would make recovering the artifacts a higher priority for law enforcement officials.
Right now, there are priceless Native American artifacts that are sold on the underground market, and these tribes deserve to have the implements and the significance of their heritage and their culture. We need to do a better job, very frankly.
Trafficking tribal artifacts and remains is illegal under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, but French courts have allowed the auctions to go forward there. Groups including the Holocaust Art Restitution Project have condemned the sales. The STOP Act will go to the Committee on Indian Affairs before possible consideration by the full Senate. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinsius in Flagstaff.
A first-term incumbent Republican representative and his Democratic opponent are both appealing to Native American voters in a tight race in Montana. As Nikki Ouellette of Montana Public Radio reports, challenger Denise Juneau is taking advantage of her Native connections to get out the vote on the Blackfeet Reservation.
Denise Juneau has an obvious advantage when campaigning on Montana's reservations. She's Mandan and Hidatsa and has spent considerable time rallying the Native American vote.
I've worked in these communities. I'm from there. I have family there. And so I just want to make sure that these communities rise up and have every opportunity as every other community does.
While walking the parade route through Browning at North American Indian Days, she's welcomed by the crowd as a hometown girl.
She was my classmate, you know. I'm proud of her. You know, she's made her mark.
I'm awfully proud of Denise, and I know the whole family.
I mean, the fact that she is Native and, she, you know, she grew up around here, that she does carry a lot of her a lot of the values that we carry with her, you know, so that's why we, you know, definitely vote for her and stuff.
Juneau is Montana's current state superintendent of public instruction. She's also running for Montana's sole seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. If she manages to upset Republican incumbent Ryan Zinke this November, she would become the first Native American woman elected to Congress.
When I come onto a reservation, particularly as a congressional candidate, I think that they see, you know, this hope and opportunity. And so I think that's really the different type of perspective and attitude than somebody who's not from these communities.
Her support is not universal, though. One person who didn't want to be identified says Juneau's roots are not enough to win his support.
You know, I'm probably going to go Republican, you know, just because, I mean, I've actually seen what these guys have done. She's Native and stuff, and, you know, I really don't know what her agenda is.
Native Americans make up roughly 8% of voters in Montana. The large majority tends to vote Democrat. Juneau began courting Native American voters early, organizing an Indian Country tour earlier this year where she spoke with members of Montana's 12 Native American tribes on all 7 of the state's reservations. In May, she proposed to debate Zinke and Libertarian candidate Mike Fellows at the Salish Kootenai College on the Flathead Reservation. Representative Ryan Zinke is not ceding the Native American vote to Juneau. He also walked at the Indian Days parade route. He's met several times with Blackfeet officials to try and help on issues they deem important. Zinke has also called for candidate debates in places with Native American voters. For National Native News, I'm Nikki Ouellette.
And I'm Stephen Emmons.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University's online Master of Social Work program, which focuses on decolonizing work with rural and indigenous communities. Applications accepted August 1st to 31st at humboldt.edu/social work.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Juno Douglas Little Theater is hosting a fundraiser on July 22nd to raise money for the victims and families of the Orlando shooting last month. To promote love, the fundraiser will be a Shakespeare celebration. Come read a monologue, sonnet, or scene from your favorite of Shakespeare's works and help spread the love. All the proceeds will go to an Orlando charity. Join us July 22nd at 6 p.m. at 360 in the K2 building. For more information, find us on Facebook or visit us at jdlittletheater.org. The site of lovers feedeth those in love.
Support comes from the Alaska Robotics Gallery, offering art that features narwhals, squid, and flying whales, located at 220 Front Street in downtown Juneau. More information at alaskarobotics.com.
And welcome back to the KTO studios. I'm Andy Klein, your host for this Friday edition of Juneau Afternoon. And joining me is Steve Benke and Tim Felstead. And they're here to talk a little bit about the draft community energy plan. And draft, I think, is an important part of this, right? This is kind of why you were talking about it. Probably want other opportunities for input, things like that.
That's right. This is a first step in talking about what the future of energy might be in Juneau.
So tell me, this, you were saying this comes from the climate action plan and a recommendation of that. So how many years in the works is this draft plan here?
Well, about 5 years ago, the CBJ adopted a climate action plan, which set out a goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 25% by 2032. One of the steps, and there's a whole bunch of different options for how to do that, and one of those recommendations was to develop a community energy plan that looks at how we can promote renewable energy and so forth.
So we were just kind of talking in between here. In my other role, I work for the brewery, and we do a lot of sustainable stuff, and we actually talk about the way that Juneau gets its electric energy, which is one of the really good things that we do here. Maybe just talk a little bit about the source of our electric energy for those listeners that may not be aware of it.
Yeah, so the source of our electric energy is probably, it's 99% from the hydropower resources that we have around Juneau. Obviously, there are times when diesel has to get used to generate electricity. So we're fortunate to be blessed with a really good source of electricity.
So we have this electric source that does not contribute to greenhouse gases. So what are the big contributors to greenhouse gases in Juneau?
Well, in Juneau, the transportation and home heating are probably the biggest chunks, categories of fossil fuel use. Our energy supply with electricity and fossil fuels, electricity makes up about 20% of the total energy that we use. And like we said, most of that comes from hydropower, mm-hmm. But the other 80% is fossil fuel based for all of our vehicles and
other things. So you kind of think about that. Are there things like, like the gases that come from the landfill, or are there other kind of sources out there that people don't typically think of that are also big contributors?
Yeah, I mean, the,
I don't know if that's one of them.
Gases from the landfill, you know, they do contribute, but most of it is from the burning of fossil fuels. I mean, the vast majority is going to be down from burning fossil fuels. And we have an inventory that was completely updated in 2010, and that really highlights which different use sectors in Juneau contribute to our community emissions. It excludes things like the cruise ships that come into town because it's all based on fuel that was sold in Juneau.
I see.
And it also excludes a lot of the aircraft that comes in and out of Juneau. So it's capturing a major percentage of all our emissions, but not completely all of them.
So of those emissions, is there a percentage, ballpark percentage associated with, say, cars and traffic?
Yeah, I think it's something like, of the fossil fuel, I think it's something like 23% vehicles and 40% something percent building, heating buildings. And then they cut another 8% or so for the mining operations, like Greens Creek and stuff.
So those three things combined are kind of the lion's share of it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what are some of the, what are some of the big recommendations of ways to reduce these gases?
So I guess building on those big areas, those big users, we've come up with 8 broader strategies. They include improving building energy efficiency, looking at electrification of the mining sector, and a shift to electrification of the transportation sector.
And increased use of renewables or electricity for heating, because there are opportunities there. For example, this proposal for the district heating for downtown Juneau would be an example of one of those kinds of options. If you could shift to using seawater heat pumps to heat big chunks of town, you would shift off of fossil fuels.
Mm. So of the recommendations, are there ones that you feel like, okay, now this would work, but it would be a massive investment in infrastructure or something? These are ones that are more incremental that could happen right now with some involvement. And then these are ones that people could just make choices on and they would contribute right away.
Yeah, there's a whole list of those kinds of with energy. There aren't really any simple answers for how to, at least in Juneau, there aren't any simple answers, and not many places else in the world either. It really is a combination of all those kinds of things. There's no one entity that controls or influences how we use energy. The CBJ has a role in this because it's a community, mm-hmm. represents a community, and so the idea, the plan is to look for things that the CBJ can do for itself. For example, there's ways to save money and save energy, by being more efficient, and the CBJ is doing some of those things already. They're switching to LED light bulbs for streetlights.
Just within government operations,
exactly. So there's a whole area of that, and mm-hmm. the plan looks at those areas because that is something that the CBJ can influence directly. And then there's other things that it can do by encouraging or setting an example. And one of the examples I think is a real good one here in town, for the kind of thing that we would see on down the road, is the Juneau Economic Development Council has something called a renewable energy cluster, and they're focusing on a couple of areas of encouraging renewable energy use. And so one of the things over the last few years that they've done is how to support and encourage electric vehicle in town. And so they've got a whole bunch of different people, from different agencies and entities and businesses who get together and come up with solutions. And they work with ALMP, the power provider, and they've come up with, putting in electric chargers and in different places in town. And they've talked about other ways to encourage and support electric vehicles.
We had such an interesting experiment in Juneau. I can't remember how many years ago it was. You probably will remember. But when the Snettisham lines were knocked out and we were going on 100% diesel for a period of time there, and we knocked our energy use down either by a third or to a third or
By a third.
That was a fascinating, got national news, right, became this really fascinating study on what people could do if they were really pushed.
That's right. We were fortunate the time of year it was, because it was starting into the spring, and so it was a little warmer than it would have been. But still, people did an amazing job of cutting their energy use back, and of course they had the incentive of all of us knowing how much our rates were going to go up paying for diesel. Generation. So, that is a really interesting example. And there are things from that, there's some of the things that apparently have carried over. ALMP says that there are certain areas where, the energy use had been climbing at a faster rate. And when that happened, it kind of it started to level off a bit as people bought more compact fluorescent bulbs and, you know, took other
sure.
steps to reduce their energy use. So there is a fair amount of flexibility in how people reduce their energy use. And, of course, the good thing is if you reduce your electric consumption, that means there's more of that nice hydropower available to use for new things like electric vehicles and other things that could reduce the fossil fuel uses
exactly.
as well. So that's kind of one step is encouraging efficiency in the use of the hydropower we have.
It does seem like we're at this time where technology has caught up, and, for instance, electric vehicles, which something, you know, 20 years ago you would have thought, well, boy, you could do it, but you really have to be kind of a, you know, techie kind of person or really into it or sort of that sort of thing. You know, now you can just, you know, you can just buy a Leaf or a Volt and, boy, you got one, and it's a great, reliable vehicle.
Yeah.
I know that the Juneau Economic Development Council is also going through some stages of saying, well, okay, now how do we get mechanics? And how do we get people to service those vehicles and those kinds of things?
Yeah, and that's another one of those, those steps. I think... And then, of course, now we're starting to see we've got our first electric bus in town that Gasno Guiding has purchased an electric bus this this summer and is getting its first season of operation. And we've had some discussions about electric buses really are starting to take off and be, you know, be a viable option. And I think we're going to see more interest in that because you've got this totally clean, you know, quiet piece of equipment that, you know, that really could enhance the quality of people's experience.
Sure,
And it's also nice because electric vehicles really are a win-win because the electric utility likes them because they kind of help spread out the load. You know, it's not a load that comes on, you know, in the morning when everybody turns on their
you can plug them in overnight.
So it can spread the load.
Right.
And so it's a, you know, so it's one of those things where it would be nice if there were more of those kind of opportunities of win-wins where people can save money because it's cheaper to operate the electric vehicle here because we got low electric rates. It, you know, it reduces greenhouse gas emissions because you're not burning fossil fuel and it works for the electricity.
Yeah. Of the big, big project kind of stuff, what are some of the big ones? What are some of the ones that maybe I don't want to use the term pie in the sky because they're probably achievable with enough investment, but what are some of the ones that people that might be part of the recommendations in this draft plan that are, you know, would be attention grabbing as far as, boy, that's a big project?
So, I mean, there's a couple of recommendations that could build up to be large projects. One of them is to keep examining the electrification of the docks. We have cruise ships that come into town. A lot of them can take shoreside electricity, and electrifying the docks to allow that capability, the new docks, would help. Although there's an expense to be paid to build all of that infrastructure and to make sure that there's enough electricity in the system available to them. And then I guess the other big one might be something like a district heating system. So, you know, there is talk of district heating systems. The Willoughby area has been touted as a good location for a district heating system, supplying energy to a lot of the big office buildings in downtown Juneau, and also other locations around Juneau where there's a concentration of maybe state, federal, or city buildings that would benefit from one central heating plant.
Yeah.
They're big outlays for infrastructure, and certainly more investigation needs to be done to see if they would pencil out.
So it's a draft plan. So now what's sort of the next step, and how can people get involved if they feel like they want to or want to get informed about this?
Sure. So we have the draft plan. It's available at the Juneau Commission on Sustainability website, and that's www.juneau.org/sustainability. We will be presenting to the Assembly Committee of the Whole this Monday on the 25th of July. But we also have a lunchtime sustainability session. These are lunchtime sessions where people can bring a brown bag and listen to talks on sustainability, and it's hosted by JCOS. And this time we're grabbing the session and talking about the draft plan. And that's on Wednesday, July 27th And that's at 12 noon at City Hall in the Assembly Chambers.
So this is looking at actually people getting the opportunity to read the plan and then come forward with ideas, or they're also going to kind of go over some of the high points of the plan as well?
Yeah. So the presentation on Wednesday, we'll be going through some of the key points of the plan, how we got there, and more importantly, what the recommendations are. But we want to use it as an opportunity to get a lot of feedback from the public. Part of the point of this plan is to try and stimulate the community of Juneau to let us know what the goals for Juneau's energy future are. It really is a first step.
Yeah, I think I would reinforce that one of the big questions is, I mean, there's obviously a whole bunch of stuff that could be done, and you mentioned there's cost questions and so forth, but I guess the first question is this something that Juneau wants to do? I mean, there's increasingly around the country, there are communities. I just read that the province of Ontario, New York City, are setting a number of Seattle, other cities are setting themselves a goal of reducing fossil fuel use 80% over the next 40 years, and setting a big goal. And that's kind of an increasingly common goal, with recognizing that scientists basically are saying they're going to have to reduce fossil fuel use over that, by those amounts of that time frame. So one question is, does Juneau want to do its part in reducing fossil fuel use and replacing it with renewable energy? And if so, how much and over what time frames? So the draft plan lays out kind of three different scenarios. It shows you the graph of kind of where things are. If they keep kind of business as usual, if we keep doing what we've been doing, and that's kind of gradually increasing our use of fossil fuels as energy demand increases. Another one would reduce it by some certain percentage to meet this goal of 25% reductions over the next 20 years or so. Although the draft plan doesn't really get us to 25% in the details we provided. And then it raises the question of, would we like to consider do a lot, mm-hmm. try and reduce it by 80%? And the plan, it's not an implementation plan. It doesn't have all the details you would need in order to accomplish that, but it lays out the background information, and it lays out the question about those goals.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd like to see a lot more discussion about that. And it's something that the Assembly then can consider adopting if it wants to adopt a goal of reducing fossil fuel use.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. I could go on and on here.
Yeah.
But we have a couple other guests. But once again, it's the draft community energy plan. It's up for discussion. There's a brown bag lunch happening Monday. Is that right?
Wednesday, 27th July, okay. 12 noon, Assembly Chambers.
And then the Monday?
And then Monday is a presentation to the Committee of the Whole for the Assembly.
Okay.
Not a chance for public comments at that. That's just to present it to the Assembly and let them hear about it.
And then the actual plan itself is available at juneau.org/sustainability, and that's where you can go and check it out, download it, read it thoroughly, and come up with questions just like what you're saying. How committed do we feel we want to be as a community for this? And
there's also an email response opportunity for people to send in questions or comments.
So you can send that to juneauenergyplan@juneau.org.
And that's something where those comments will be taken into consideration and incorporated.
They're all collected, and on some of them I've been providing some clarifying feedback as well.
And then what's the timeline on a finished product, on a final for this? Good smiles all around.
Yeah, good. Well, our first step is to get public comment back by September 2nd.
Okay.
And in the meantime, we're figuring out, we'll kind of see. I mean, some of it depends on what kind of feedback we get from the Assembly.
How much work is required for research things like that.
So it's going to be kind of ongoing. For energy is a big topic.
Yeah,
it's going to be a long-term discussion.
Well, thanks so much, Steve Behnke and Tim Felstead, for coming in and talking to us about the draft community energy plan. Once again, it's at juneau.org/sustainability, where you can download the plan, check it out, and give your comments. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the chance.
Thank you. Well, every year college students here in Juneau and elsewhere go on to spend a number of weeks on the Juneau Ice Field. We get to see them in the parade and everything. And this year they took up with them a digital recorder. And we're going to hear now from the first of a series documenting life on the ice field.
Juneau, this is Ellie Honan here from Ireland, calling to you from Camp 17 on Blackaby Ridge. I'm here with the Juneau Icefield Research Programme, or JERP as it's fondly known, which every year sends students and researchers to the Juneau Icefield to live and research this remote glacial environment right in Juneau's backyard. 10 days ago, we left the Home Depot parking lot, loaded down with our clothes and gear to cross the Juneau Icefield to Atlin, Canada, over the course of 6 weeks. It took 2 days for over 40 people from all over the planet to hike 17 kilometres through forest, vertical swamp, snow and ice to Camp 17, located at the head of the Lemon Creek Glacial Valley, where we're talking to you from now. Camp 17 is a hodgepodge collection of 9 buildings that at times house over 50 people. It's here where JERP teaches students the ways of icefield living, everything from crevasse rescue and ski practice to field drawing techniques and glacial geophysics. We're here today with JERP Academic Director Dr. Matt Beadle, born and raised here in Juneau and currently studying the glaciers of British Columbia. So Matt, tell us a bit about JERP.
Many of you may know of JERP from many JERPers hiking in the 4th of July parade year after year. Unfortunately, some 10 years ago, due to shifting calendars at academic institutions, we had to shift the calendar of JERP. And so instead of marching in the parade, we celebrate 4th of July at 4,000 feet at Camp 17, but we are still around. JERP can trace its history back to the early 1940s when William O. Field, or Bill Field, brought the young Harvard student Maynard Miller to Southeast Alaska to study the recession of glaciers. Maynard and Bill collaborated then to start the Juneau Icefield Research Program. Maynard Miller and Bill Field's hypothesis was that to understand the behavior of the lower reaches of the glaciers, one had to go to the upper reaches where snow accumulates to derive an understanding of how they behaved. This launched the Juneau Icefield Research Program in the mid-1940s. And for the past 70 years, JERPers have been traversing the Juneau Icefield. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, JERP the project transitioned to JERP the program under the leadership of Dr. Maynard Miller and his wife Joan. This became a family affair for numerous decades in which Mal and Joan led the program which brought students into nature. Dr. Miller was fond to say that this made all the difference. A key driving force behind their passion for the program was the importance of interesting young people in science. Today, we still traverse the Juneau Icefield, and we have strong ties to the University of Alaska Southeast, with numerous faculty and students coming from Juneau and UAS. However, our cohort is international, with faculty members and students from across the planet.
Thank you, Matt. That was fascinating. Now, we've heard what JERP is. Let's hear a bit about what it is that the program actually does. We're here talking to Chris McNeil, who was a student with JERP in 2009 and recently completed a master's degree looking at the health of the Juneau Icefield glaciers. So Chris, many people in Juneau think that they can see the Lemon Creek Glacier from Egan, but what they're actually looking at is the Thomas Glacier, a small hanging glacier next to the Lemon. You've done a huge amount of work on the Lemon Glacier these past few years, so can you tell us a bit about what's happening to it and why it matters to the people of Juneau?
Yeah, so you used to be able to see Lemon Creek Glacier when it terminated down in the valley, but since the 1950s, the glacier has been continuously retreating. Since then, it's lost 17% of its surface area and 0.4 gigatons of mass, which is roughly equivalent to about 40 million elephants. And we know this because JERP is responsible for continuing North America's longest glacier mass balance record.
So mass balance is a huge aspect of the work carried out here at JERP. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So you can think of glacier mass balance like balancing a glacier's checkbook, where each winter the glacier gets a paycheck in the form of snowfall, and then during the summer the glacier pays its bills in the form of snow and ice melt. If the glacier gains more mass than it loses, then the glacier has a positive balance. It's put some money into its savings account. But if the glacier loses more mass than it's gained, then it has a negative balance. The glacier's in debt to climate. We've been seeing this across the state. In fact, Alaskan glaciers are changing at some of the fastest rates outside of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets, which directly raise sea level. This is relevant to coastal communities just like Juneau. This water also carries with it a huge amount of nutrients, which is the basis of the food chain in the Gulf of Alaska as well.
So that could potentially have knock-on effects for industries such as fishing or tourism here in the Juneau region.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. So thank you to all who listened. Do tune in over the next few weeks to hear more stories from the ice field. I'm Ellie Honan with the Juneau Icefield Research Program. This is Camp 17, over.
Yo, VIP, let's kick it.
Oh, Juneau Icefield. Fascinating report, and glad to hear that's going to be the first of a series of reports on the Juneau Icefield, letting us know what those folks are doing up there, and fascinating that they've been doing it for so long and really created this great collection of data that's telling us exactly what's happening up there. Fascinating stuff. Well, you were listening to Hey Juneau Afternoon, I'm Andy Klein, your host for this Friday, where today the rain is in the forecast and we've got highs in the mid-50s, southeast winds about 15 miles an hour. And then tonight, rain is called for again with lows in the mid-50s and southeast winds at 20 miles an hour. For Saturday, rain might be heavy at times and highs in the mid-50s, southeast winds to 20 miles an hour. Saturday night, rain showers again. And then Sunday, widespread rain showers, highs in the mid-50s and southeast winds to 10 miles per hour. Well, we had our great weather. Now we've got a little, you know, we need the rain. We need the rain. All right. Coming up next, we're going to hear from Garrison Keillor. We've got a great little bit on Gordon Tentries coming up, who's playing at the Alaskan this weekend. And then we're going to be hearing from Christy Nami Erickson. She's going to be talking about a very special event happening this weekend. But first, here is Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 22nd of July, 2016. Today is the birthday of the painter Edward Hopper, born in Nyack, New York, 1882. He was an admirer of the French Impressionist painters like Monet, the way they depicted light, especially the light of Paris. In 1962, Hopper said he still considered himself an Impressionist, even though the style had long been out of fashion. He said there's a sort of elation about sunlight on the upper part of a house. He had a day job as an illustrator while he produced paintings of his own, lived in Greenwich Village, overlooking Washington Square, married a fellow painter, Josephine Navisan, who persuaded him to switch from oil to watercolors, had a successful one-man show, so he was able to quit his illustrator job that he hated. In 1942, he painted his famous picture, Nighthawks, the couple sitting at the counter of a New York diner, a man sitting alone, the counterman in white, one of the most recognizable paintings in the history of art. It's the birthday of the poet Emma Lazarus, New York City, 1849, who wrote the sonnet, Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, that's on a plaque at the Statue of Liberty. It's the birthday of Tom Robbins, 1932, Blowing Rock, North Carolina. Dropped out of college, hitchhiked around the country, wound up in Greenwich Village, joined the Air Force, became a meteorologist, moved to Seattle to get away from the South. His first book, Another Roadside Attraction, came out in 1971, about a married couple who own a hot dog stand, who steal the mummy of Jesus. Even Cowgirls Get the Blues has a hitchhiker with abnormally large thumbs. Jitterbug Perfume, about a king who lives for 1,000 years and ends up as Einstein's janitor. Tom Robbins describes his latest book as an unmemoir called Tibetan Peach Pie, a true account of an imaginative life. And it's the birthday of the novelist S.E. Hinton, born Tulsa, 1948. When she was 15, she started working on a book called The Outsiders, which was published in 1967. She was in her first year at the University of Tulsa. It became one of the most popular young adult books ever, has sold more than 14 million copies. Here's a poem for today by Leo Dangle, How to Take a walk. This is farming country. The neighbors will believe you are crazy if you take a walk just to think and be alone. So carry a shotgun and walk the fence line. Pretend you're hunting, and your walking will not arouse suspicion. But don't forget to load the shotgun. They will know if your gun is empty. Stop occasionally. Cock your head and listen to the doves you never see. Part the tall weeds with your hand and inspect the ground. Sniff the air as a hunter would. That wonderful smell of sweet clover is a bonus. Soon you will forget the gun in your hands, but remember, someone may be watching. If you hear beating wings and see the bronze flash of something flying up, you will have to shoot it. A poem by Leo Dangle, How to Take a Walk, from his collection Home from the Field, published by Spoon River Poetry Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity, brain training with over 50 challenging games from scientists working with university researchers to push cognitive research forward. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Do you like your country and rock, your folk and your blues, all in the same sound? Or do you like your music independent, honest, real, with blue-collar roots? Tune in to Southern Exposure Friday nights at 7 for a unique blend of Red Dirt, Americana, Outlaw, and more with me, your host, Red Stewart. At Southern Exposure, Friday nights at 7 on KRNN FM Juneau, music and arts from Alaska's capital.
And welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. Well, Gordon Tentries is going to be playing this weekend at the Alaskan, and our own Jeff Brown got a chance to talk to him briefly. Here's that.
So you're off on a 200-day tour of the world. Why are you doing this?
It's something I've done before. I have been doing it for about 10 years, and every time I put out a record, I tend to spread myself around in as many different places as I can.
And you've got 6 CDs out?
That's correct. I just released a new one a year ago called Less is More, and I've been touring it ever since.
You're known as a storyteller and a songwriter. Which comes with more important to you, the storytelling or the songwriting?
For sure the songs are, but, you know, every song has a story. And about, you know, 5 different ways to tell it. Sometimes, I don't even think about it anymore. I just kind of get on stage with the idea of which song I want to play first, and then I take a look at the audience and decide what I'm going to do to them.
Where do the stories come from, or where do the songs come from?
They come from experiences, life experiences, or things that are attractive to me. Different moments in time, or usually they're about characters. A lot of stories I have are about the North and where I live in the Yukon, and about my travels and the different experiences I've had.
Who are your inspirations, musically and storytelling-wise?
I'd have to say, musically, some Canadian artists like Fred Eaglesmith and Rick Fiennes. I'm a huge fan of bluegrass and old-time music, as well as blues music. So I'm really into old acoustic blues artists, Mississippi Fred McDowell. I'm really interested in Texas singer-songwriters like Tom Van Zandt and Sam Baker and Guy Clark. I'd say it runs itself all over the place and changes all the time.
You're playing at the Alaskan tonight and tomorrow night. What's going to be happening?
Well, I'll be playing solo, so I'll be playing a bunch of guitars, some slide guitar and some harmonica, and I also have some foot percussion going on. So it's kind of a one-man band show. I'm going to play songs from all my records and tell some stories, and some of it will be more intimate and stuff that people will want to listen to, and other the stuff will be more high energy that people can dance to. So it's something for everybody.
All right. Gertie, thank you for being on the air with me today.
Oh, thanks, Jeff, for having me. I really appreciate it. Looking forward to coming down there.
You're on tonight at about 10 o'clock?
I'll be on there tonight and tomorrow night around 10 o'clock both nights, yeah.
All right. Thanks, Gertie.
Thanks, Jeff. Have a great day.
Time eats everything with a left hook to the chin. Straight, right counter, there's nothing sounder, even Bill Monroe can swing. They cut you over and over again, you keep seeing your son grow old with his friends. Death feels fine, you're tired of time, tired of time. Cold beer and to coach the flames. Scooping tickets to your last game, even Lenny McDonald came. You think I'm back to how your mom met your dad, knowing you'll never see them die. The infield is fine, the outfield takes time, the outfield takes time. Home alone, wishing with nonsense holding your stride. Grazing on the touch of her love, a man so full of pride. Sunrise to bedside, hearts to the blind side, of hope losing light every day. Love can withstand a dying man, a dying man.
Well, that's a little bit of Gordy Kotentries there that you got to hear Jeff Brown interview right before that. He's on a 200-city tour across the continent and will be here playing this weekend at the Alaskan. He'll be playing tonight, starting at about 10 o'clock, and be playing tomorrow night as well, both at the Alaskan. That was great to hear that. That was accompanied there by Jackson Haldane, who was on mandolin, but Gordy's going to be here alone, so he said he's going to be a little bit of a one-man band performing there on the Alaskan stage, which sounds like a fun thing to go check out. We're going to hear next from Bird Note, and then we've got to talk to Christy Nami Erickson, who's going to be telling us about the details of Sunday's community art and dialogue event to discuss racial justice and anti-violence. We're going to hear from that right after Bird Note.
This is Bird Note.
I can hear the birds, I can see them fly, I can see the sky.
Ask any child to draw a bird, and they'll likely draw a head with eyes and a beak, but no ears. Because unlike mammals, birds have no external ear structures. Their ear openings are hidden beneath feathers on the side of the head, just behind and slightly below the eyes. In mammals, the external ear structure helps funnel sound in, and it's crucial for figuring out where a sound is coming from. Birds, too, can locate where a sound comes from, even without external ears. But how? Recent research on crows, ducks, and chickens suggests that it's the shape of a bird's head that holds the key. In fact, the head does the same job for birds that the external ear does for humans. It has slightly oval contours, and when sound waves reach it, some bounce off, some are diffracted or bent out of shape, and some pass right through. These sounds that go right through are registered by the opposite ear. By measuring how loud the sounds are in both ears, the bird is able to identify whether a sound is coming from above it or below it. And visual input is extremely important too, helping the bird get an all-around impression of the world. So it's able to assess whether there's a predator nearby or not. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. I can hear the bird.
I can see the fly. Bird Note there, and joining me now on the phone is Christy Nami Erickson. Christy, you there?
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it. And you're going to be involved in this event happening Sunday, the Racial Justice and Anti-Violence event that's happening at the UAS Rec Center. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about what you think the event's going to be about and also what's prompting it.
Yeah. Well, to tell you the truth, I think I'm coming out of a particularly dark space where I was processing a lot of kind of events that are happening nationally in terms of violence against black and brown men and communities. And as a woman of color, as a mother, I kind of went into this difficult headspace trying to figure it all out. And the way that I got out of it, or at least am trying to get out of it, is through art. And so as I started to imagine what can we do here in our community to process some of these events together, I thought, of course, let's do it through art. So on Sunday, we're having an event that will showcase some visual arts as well as some performance pieces as a way of kind of prompting, sort of catalyzing a conversation that has to do with, you know, in what ways can art kind of help us express some difficult topics, some difficult feelings, and how can art and conversation and dialogue and connection help move us forward so that we can deal with those feelings in a way that's constructive, in a way that's working towards anti-violence and towards racial justice in our town.
Tell me a little bit about the joining of those two things, which sometimes anti-violence, racial justice, I understand the connection, but can you describe to me the reason why you felt like both of those things needed to be discussed together?
Absolutely. I think that when you're looking at the conversation nationally, we're seeing a lot of conversation around the opposite end, right? Racism and violence. And we're seeing the mixture of those two things is what, for many folks, myself included, believe to be prompting some of these shootings that we're seeing videotaped, and just the police brutality, I guess the reality of police brutality, has in many ways shaped a conversation about violence and about racism and the way that those intersect. And so we want to have a conversation about that, but we want to do it in a way that's uplifting, a way that kind of talks about racism, but in a way that's on the path for justice, in a way that intersects with understanding that violence is part of the reason that that stimulated this conversation today, and to be very clear that that was one avenue that we're specifically trying to create a framework around in a conversation about racial justice, because racial justice could go in a lot of different directions, and we just want to be very efficient, I guess, with our time on Sunday, so that we have a starting point and a direction that we're all kind of working from as we look to how can we create a more racially just and anti-violent community.
Because people are angry. I mean, people are angry, right? And that so often can lead to a violent reaction.
I'm speaking less about a reactionary violence and more about the violence that is preceding that type of rage, right? The violence of Alton Sterling being shot, right? Philando Castile being shot in his car with his girlfriend there and a daughter in the back seat, right? Five Latinos killed in the last couple of weeks in the Southwest. So I'm talking more about that particular kind of violence as opposed to the violence of a rage or an anger or any type of outburst on the flip side. We've seen that, but to the degree that it has been a systemic issue, right, in the way that police brutality has been a systemic issue, is a distinction that I want to make.
So that's interesting. So in other words, the idea behind, and we'll talk a little bit more about the event here, but it's just an interesting discussion that I think is kind of, it's a cathartic discussion to have with people, right? How do we describe these events? We all have this visceral reaction to the video we've seen, to the kind of what, as you say, the systemic nature of what's been happening.
Right.
And then, so then there's calls for, well, now what? What do we do? What do we do about it?
Totally, Andy. And I think that, you know, part of what's going to happen at the event is creating a space that really does allow folks to reflect on how are you feeling in multiple ways, right? What are you thinking about, right? What are you thinking about with the problem, with the solution? What are you feeling about, right? What are kind of like, what's that rage, that sadness, that darkness, you know, how can we name that and kind of give attention, give ourselves the gift of paying attention to that for a moment? And also that what you describe as kind of that visceral feeling for me often feels like an action. Like I feel like my body just wants to do something, wants to build something, wants to go somewhere, right, with all of these feelings and thoughts. And we want to really be able to address that. You know, what is that feeling and what are some things that we can concrete, what are some concrete things that we can be doing? What are some commitments that we can be making based on our own roles in our community here in Juneau?
So the event itself, what's going to be happening?
Yeah, so when people arrive, we're going to have some visual art and just some different interactive activities placed around the room. And the first 20 to 30 minutes is just kind of a self-guided response and reflection, right? You just, we'll welcome you in, and then you make yourself at home to kind of engage with different pieces to the level and time that you want to. After that, we'll round everybody up, sit down, and then we're going to do about five very short performances by some different artists and artists of color in town, specifically talking on these topics, racial justice and anti-violence. After that, we'll transition into what's known as an Andor-style community dialogue. Andor is the Alaska Native Dialogues on Racial Equity project that comes out of First Alaskans Institute. And so it's just some different facilitation techniques that help us as Alaskans and using some certain values, Alaskan values, to help guide a conversation. And I've been telling folks that we're committed to creating a safe and supportive space in that environment, and you don't have to come bearing any type of expertise or specific roles in the community or even having any kind of answers. All of the questions that we'll be asking or that we'll be prompting some dialogue about are things that if you've just been paying attention or if you've been listening to some of these performances that you've just experienced, you know, what are kind of some of your feelings and thoughts that you're experiencing right now, and what are some experiences that you've had, what are some things you're thinking about, right? They're all questions that anybody in our community will be able to answer.
And it seems like you've really reached out and designed this event with a lot of different groups in mind and collaboratively with a lot of different groups.
Yeah, I think that when you're dedicated to creating a community dialogue, it's important that you reach out to the community, right, and you make sure that you have a little bit of input and feedback and are working in solidarity with groups that you're hoping to work in solidarity with on a community-wide focus anyway. So I've had the privilege of talking to and getting support from a variety of different arts, cultural, and social justice organizations in our community. So I'm really excited to have their support and their presence on Sunday for sure.
And I can just go through a list of them. This Black Awareness Association of Juneau, the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, University of Alaska Southeast, Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, Perseverance Theater, the UAS Native and Rural Student Center, Northern Light United Church, the Juneau Police Department, the Juneau Interfaith Coalition, Juneau People for Peace and Justice, AWARE, and the Juneau Violence Prevention Coalition. And
the Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp 3 also signed on this morning.
Well, there you go. Great. And just it seems like it's such a great collective representation of not just the people maybe are on sort of the front lines of the issue, but also supportive community organizations as well.
Absolutely. I think the bottom line is we're really looking at how can we be a better community, right? How can we be a safer, more supportive, more inclusive community? We know we're diverse, and we know we already value that. How can we take it to the next level? And for this particular event, for this particular conversation, we're choosing to do that at least at the beginning with art. And so that's why you see some of the art-based organizations signing on to that and really recognizing that art can be a tool for social change. And I like to say that as an artist, I'm offering up my services as an artist, the way I see the world, right, the skills that I might provide in being able to express things in a different way, and if that can be a way that can help facilitate learning, help facilitate expression, help facilitate dialogue, then I absolutely want to be a part of that. And so I'm really grateful to the artists who are lending their skills and talents to this event, and definitely grateful to all the organizations that are trusting us with being able to host an inclusive dialogue on the topic.
Well, once again, it's a creative conversation on racial justice and anti-violence. It's happening this Sunday from 2 to 5, and that's at the UAS Rec Center. Christy Nami Erickson, thanks so much for discussing this with us, and have a great and interesting and valuable conversation on Sunday.
Thank you so much, Andy. I appreciate your time.
Sure, thank you. And that's it for a Juno Afternoon this Friday. Thanks to all my guests for joining me. And have a great weekend.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on